legislature hasn't established. So, obviously, in that situation, you are going to find a fair amount of different sentences, all the way from 7, 10 years to life. Third, it is my impression, based upon the conversations I have had with prisoners, it is my impression that disparity of sentencing is regarded as an evil, but that disparity of parole treatment is regarded as at least equal, or maybe even greater evil, from their standpoint. Finally, I think that the judge should participate in it. The judge more nearly represents the community sense than does the parole board. And the judge, as the voice of the community and of the legal structure, probably is better able to impose a maximum at the time. He should also, as is presently the case, he should also at the time express his point of view as to how long he believes the man should serve. There is presently statutory provision for a pre-sentence report. Many judges do not submit this. Most sheriffs and DAs do not submit it. Some judges do, and I'm told by the parole board that where the judge takes the trouble to submit those recommendations, they are given weight. He should submit such a recommendation because the parole board or the releasing authority should be aware of what plan the judge envisions. After that, the judge should not be a part of the releasing process because his familiarity with the person diminishes and the familiarity of knowledge of the person increases in the corrections division parole board. And having made such a long speech, I apologize, Mr. Chairman, but I would join Lee Johnson in hoping that the persons here can be heard after all the members of the commission are heard.
Frankly, I would other people are hoping that they can be heard. But the one thing, Jim, I would ask you, you say the judge is a representative of the community. Would you say that most of the sentences today represent the community's attitude?
Not necessarily. I think the solution, though, for what disparity does exist lies in the increased use of sentencing panels, increased use of sentencing institutes, increased communication between judges and others in the correction process, so that all parts of it are made aware of the common problems that exist.
I heard you were going to be the next tax cut.
In Logan
right?
County.
And I wrote you
to some extent in other areas of the state.
It's true.
I would say, though, that the only way you really know the problem of disparity is to get inside that joint and talk to some of those people where they'll really open up to you. And the rest of this time, we can talk all we want about disparity, but that's in our mind. And the problem of disparity is when it exists in the mind of the guy that we're in there, that is inside, and we're trying to correct it.
Fine. Lee, do you wish to call the gentlemen that are here to see?
Come on up.
Okay. Have you sit right next to Harl there, and we'd be interested in your.
I don't have the slightest idea where these people stand.
I haven't either.
It's a matter of trying to find out.
Correction Division's general position, and my personal position is that the present law should be left like it is. For several reasons. I would support Judge Burns when he said that some sentences should be different. I don't think the crime is an awfully good measure of the kinds of problems that a guy has. And I think there's some rational justification for sending people to commit robberies for different periods of time. The other thing that you're suggesting is that there's some kind of we have hunches as to how we decide when a man is ready to go from an institution on parole, but that's really all it is. Some of the recent studies that we've seen suggest that the time in prison and success on parole are really not directly related to each other, which is kind of a scary kind of finding, but this has been the finding so far. One of the things that happened is that we look at a man's adjustment in a very abnormal situation where he has many decision-making responsibilities taken away from him, and the discipline problems and so on he has in prison may or may not relate to the kind of problems he would have out in a free society. Some people just don't like to be in prison, and I wouldn't like to be in prison. Another thing that is a problem in this whole area is how do we? I think we have now with the work release law and the temporary leave law an opportunity to test how responsible people are. I think this is obviously a good kind of guideline for the parole board. I feel that the judge, particularly if there are pre-sentence investigations made mandatory on all felony cases, I think this is something we've never reached. I think it's about, 30-40% statewide. Maybe 50% of the felony sentence have pre-sentence investigations statewide.
Now?
It's much higher in Multnomah County, much higher in Lane County. Quite low in some other
counties. Well, I wasn't aware of that. I had the impression in Multnomah County that it's almost a very rare situation in Multnomah County.
The figure that John gave you the other was 60%.
Oh, possibly 60. But I would estimate it's about
50. Rare in Washington.
And I would think that in terms of some guide for sentencing, the pre-sentence reports, there is something. I don't know whether this group would consider make this mandatory, but this is certainly one way to get rid of the great differences that aren't really related to the man, in terms of the attitudes people have. I came from California. I've been out of 2 years. I was in Oregon for a number of years. Went to California. Got to look at their system a little bit. What's happened in the last 2 or 3 years before the present administration took office and appointed the present parole board, the average length of stay in the California prison system was about 20 months. In about 3 years, it went to 36 months, simply because there was a change in the kind of view that people had in terms of how much time people ought to spend in prison and how much time they ought to come out. They've had a probation subsidy program and greatly increased the number on probation, greatly extended the length of time that people stay in prison, so they're still responsible in terms of their prison situation.
Well, wouldn't that naturally follow if you increase probation that you're going to increase the average length of sentence of those who qualify for probation?
The legislature, in their Office of Research, has done the study that I was referring to here, done by Robin Lamson, a researcher employed by the legislature, who couldn't really find any kind of relationship between success with the 36 months, or even they've done some experiments in California. They paroled someone half the time they would have been paroled in to see what would happen, and no difference in terms of the way they get along. So really, the judge is really saying this guy needs this much punishment. I'm not sure it really relates to whether he's going to get along. I don't know.
It might not be inappropriate to observe, if I interrupt Wayne, that one of the comments on the wisdom of parole boards as opposed to that of judges was demonstrated in Florida after the Gideon decision, in which they opened the doors because they had to, and they ran a study on 100 or 120 cases who were released because they hadn't had a lawyer. They just opened the door. And then they took a comparable 100 or 150 guys that were released through the parole process, and the rate of recidivism was almost twice as high among those who were released by the parole board than it was where they just opened the door. This kind of shocked everybody because they said, gee whiz, is there any sense at all to our system? I don't say that as a blank criticism.
Well, it's blanket criticism on the whole system is what that really is. It goes to the point that our sentencing structure everywhere in this country is too long. That's what you have.
Duane, do you wish to go on?
Just to support this, I was going to say that the legislature did a very wise thing in giving temporary relief authority to the division and work release authority. Because it gives us for the first time an opportunity to contest some things that you can't test when a man is behind a high wall. We have people that play the game very well, yes sir, no sir, you know, real good people in terms of institutionalization, called institutionalized. And the guy that's a real orangutan in terms of objecting to what maybe a reasonable man would say was an unreasonable kind of rule, but there's some of this. I think this may be even more so if we get more idealistic kinds of people to see justice as in a very different way and so on. This has not been a good measure of whether men are ready for parole control. That's why all the board has to go on and all the team has to go on. So we're trying some other ways of testing people. But I really feel that that the judge, the community, and the community climate is something that he's much more aware of than the parole board can be in making some judgment. I'm not sure that there's any magic in the parole board setting the time. I think you can have uniform sentences, but maybe uniformly long. This is a possibility. This is what worries us.
Well, did you say legislature giving you temporary release authority? Is that what you said, Dwayne?
Yes.
Are you utilizing that to any great extent, letting people go out on furloughs for...
More at the correctional institution where we have than we are at the prison.
It's just like weekend passes to go home?
Up to 30 days.
How, just since 69?
Yes.
How many have you granted?
They've had several hundred go out of the correctional institution with 100% success in terms of return.
They've all come back?
All come back with no problem. We've had maybe 50 or 60 in prison, no problem either in terms of coming back. We're really quite conservative about this in the beginning, and I think we intend to be. Because this is one of the very difficult decisions the board has and the institution has in terms of how do you select the guy that you take a risk on.
Who makes the temporary release?
The superintendent is the one that, well, actually, essentially the superintendent is staff.
But the board doesn't have any.
The board has no role in this. The board has some input. This happened in terms of readiness for parole. This is valuable information for the board. This guy was out a week or out 48 hours or out 2 weeks looking for a job or whatever reason he sent out. This is very valuable input for the board in terms of what they've got in front of them. Work release experience is the same kind of input for the board. And the board has been quite interested in how he got along with going into a halfway house or into a jail at night, working out the daytime.
Well, Duane, do you feel that with the work release program and the temporary release provisions that have been passed by the legislature, that this wide disparity of the 70 judges in the state is hindering your program particularly?
I think we're going to in terms of recommendations for it. See, we have an option now we didn't have before when we had no way to go except parole board or discharge. This is another option. And we can, if we feel strongly that the guy is ready to go, even if the board isn't ready to consider, do some other things, and the board sometimes changes its mind. So this is an option that tends to reduce the disparity, I think, if we're willing to take that risk.
And at least until such time as you develop some history, reliable history upon this, it's your opinion, I understand it, that we should retain the system we have now.
You had this grease, didn't you?
No, I look like Lee Johnson. Is there anything else you wish to add?
Don't say any more. You're satisfied.
Thank you very much.
Hearing's over.
Mr. Evans, Walter Evans, who's the Chief U.S. Probation Officer for Oregon, I understand, and also President of the Criminal Justice Research Association. Are you not, Mr. Evans?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'd like very much to have your general views.
Gentlemen, I want to say that being here is a privilege. We got great education this morning. This is, they're all well informed, and I left over some of the papers that have been prepared here, and I'm curious to believe that most of our studies are there's very little really that I can add to what Judge Byrne just said and what William Lundley said. I think the critical point in the whole process is the time sensitive. And there are other ways of getting at disparity than ways of trying to pay us. And I think perhaps some of these should be looked to in the future. For example, the judges of the Parole Board too ought to have available to them the figures as to the types of sentences that are being given in the various jurisdictions. And if the judges had this feedback, I think this would be helpful. And it would be helpful for the Parole Board too. I just returned from a sentencing institute with the federal judges in Phoenix, Arizona. And the sentencing institutes conducted on the federal level have to a large extent done away with the disparity. And this was stated by the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. This doesn't mean that there isn't still some disparity. There's very notable examples. Largely, the disparity has been reduced, and primarily because of the sentencing institutes. This is another way of getting at it, and I know that that isn't a question before this body. I thought perhaps I should mention. I feel, as I said, that the point of sentencing is the critical time in the whole process, because everything that follows after that will depend upon the sentence that's given at that time. The judges need every bit of expertise that they can gain in giving sentences. I think that the process ought to be as simple as possible. I think this is a matter that you're primarily concerned with. The court has the opportunity at that time to make a determination as to whether it wants to retain jurisdiction or pass the responsibility to another agency. If the court wants to retain jurisdiction, it does it through probation. If it wants to pass the responsibility to another agency, then it's to the Division of Corrections. As I understand the present law here, you have the, in effect, an indeterminate statute. And this gives the Division of Corrections and it gives the parole board the widest possible latitude. And as I understand it, the courts have the widest possible latitude. And this is to be decided.
Well, I wonder if you could say just a word or two about what your impression is of the. I don't think our draft specifically gets into this, but the use in the federal system of the diagnostic center, the maximum sentence, and so on, where they send them to hump off for 90 days and then bring it back to the end of the sentence.
In the federal system, as Judge Burns indicates, there is provision for a period of observation and study. And this is usually reserved for the most complicated, the most difficult cases where the behavior is so bizarre that the court is unable to understand really what motivates the individual, and the pre-sentence investigation doesn't adequately disclose what the problems are. The defendant may be committed for a period of 60 days or 90 days to the Attorney General, and at the close of a study period, the report is made back to the court, a comprehensive report covering the social history, medical, psychological, and other factors of the individual's life, with a recommendation to the court as to what disposition should be made. And this procedure has been highly beneficial to the court on the federal level. I don't know whether you have such procedure in Oregon or not.
No, we don't.
Chairman said,
Chairman, I withdraw my motion.
Tony was saying he wanted to make sure that Reed would have plenty of time to ask questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. Does anybody have any questions? Thank you. Hopefully.
Thank you. Well, I should add one thing on behalf of Criminal Justice Research Associates. We have some, this organization is a nonprofit corporation which is dedicated to the proposition of improving the criminal justice system. And we have some very outstanding members in the association, people in the state of Oregon here. And if the commission would desire, we could and would bring consultants to explain that offer.
Is that the group that Fred Inbaugh is, was out here? No, that's something else. Well, thank you very much. We'll definitely keep that in mind. Hope you come back.
Judge Burns.
Yes.
That St. River, I heard down the road.
Matter of fact, the group had the benefit of hearing from the Solicitor General at one of his recent meetings.
Archibald Cox or Jake Penn?
Too.
What? Archie Cox or Jake Penn?
Jake Penn.
Oh, well, that was a real benefit.
Well, what's the way?
Well, I'm glad as soon as you heard the other stuff.
Do you have anything further to add, Liddy?
I already made my statement. I said I withdrew my motion.
I was with
you. I get count the votes.
I was with you.
When you're a chief witness,
I'm a good loser.
Well,
yeah, you don't spell very well.
Speller, but you're a good loser.
Let's go back, loser. Regular course.
I have a question on section one, Mr. Chairman. Maybe it's premature.
Is this on Article 8?
Yes, I thought that's where you were
going. Well, correct. Okay, Judge Burns.
I noticed that
8 days the formal statement.
Sub 5 says that when a person is convicted and the court does not suspend the imposition or execution of sentence, or when a suspended sentence or probation is revoked, the court shall impose the following sentence. The discharge of the defendant. I wonder if that is inconsistent with
revocation?
No. With section 9 of the previous article, which speaks about one of the ways in which a felony becomes a misdemeanor is when the court grants probation without imposition of sentence and the defendant is thereafter discharged. It seems to me that it's important that we make it clear that the power to grant discharge is available either at the sentencing time. The court says I'm going to suspend imposition of sentence and I'm going to discharge the defendant, or I'm going to suspend imposition of sentence and place the defendant on probation. And then 3 years later, let's say, you bring the defendant back in and say, now I'm going to discharge the defendant. The power to grant the discharge should be available anywhere along the line. And I can see that 5 may be susceptible of the construction that the only time the discharge can be granted is when either 1, you don't suspend imposition, or 2, when you have revoked probation. Well, now I'm sure that isn't what was intended, but I'm concerned that it may be.
What you're saying is that you don't think that it provides the court with continuing authority to do it.
Well, you see, in under 9 sub F, if the court grants probation to a defendant without imposition of sentence, and defendant is thereafter discharged, that contemplates that I suspend imposition of sentence.
Put him on probation.
Put him on probation, and 3 years later, I discharge him.
Right.
All right, now, sub 5 implies that that isn't available. And I want to make sure it is available.
If an offense, and the court should not suspend the imposition of imposition of sentence.
To 9?
Well,
would that do it?
I think maybe the way to get out of it, I don't think it's in the system.
I don't think, when it convicts of an offense and the court doesn't suspend the imposition, in other words, the court does suspend the imposition of sentence and place the guy on probation.
Then it doesn't have to do A through A, B, C, or D.
Well, in other words, it has to be read in context and in its relationship to the either the imposition or execution of or the suspension of the imposition of sentence or probation. And in that relationship, if the court doesn't do any of those things, either suspend the imposition or execution of sentence or place the defendant on probation, it has these following alternatives open to it. But that's for the purposes of what it, what the court can do if it decides not to use those tools. Whereas in context of the other sentence or the other section, we're talking about how a felony becomes a misdemeanor.
Well, I appreciate that, but you see,
is that your condition?
Look at section 2, where it says, duty on the court to pass sentence in accordance with this section. And it says, when a person is convicted, if it's in the best interest of the public and so forth, the court may suspend the imposition or execution of sentence and may also place the defendant on probation. And presumably, from Section 9, presumably thereafter, at some time, the court can discharge, because that's one of the ways in which a felony becomes a misdemeanor. If the court, however, sub 5 still seems to say that the only way you can discharge is when you haven't suspended imposition, or when you have granted probation and revoked. Under those circumstances, then you can do a number of things, one of which is discharge. Maybe this is a restrictive reading. I want to be sure that it's clear that if you suspend the imposition sentence and put him on probation for 3 years, and sometime later you can haul the guy back in if he's done a good job and say, I discharge. Here.
All right. And then it would be a misdemeanor.
Correct.
What if you suspend execution? What if he's convicted of second degree robbery or first degree robbery? Suspend execution, put him on probation for 5 years, and after 3 years you call him back in and discharge him. Would it then be a felony?
Yeah, you can. As a matter of fact, that the discharge authority is further limited with respect to under section 5 of authority of the court in sentencing, we set out criteria for discharging the defendant. And we limited the convictions for an offense other than murder, treason, or a class A or B felony. So that leaves him at a class C felony.
So if it was a class C felony and you suspended execution, then it would be a felony?
It would be a felony, but the court would
still discharged.
That's right.
The only thing that we would require the court to state its reasons for the record, if it's a felony.
You think my problem is loser?
I would be glad if you want some additional commentary on it.
I suggest that you do...
back to the old commentary.
Well, I don't think there's anything we can do to the statute, frankly, that's clear up what you're talking about.
But I think you maybe should make it clear in the commentary that it's intended to give the court continuing authority to grant a discharge, notwithstanding a otherwise rigid interpretation.
Because although, for the purpose of discussion, we've broken this down into three separate articles, they all have to be read together, and I think when they're codified and placed into 137, that it's all, I think it's going to be more understandable, perhaps, when they're laid side by side.
You will include this discussion in your commentary.
Yeah.
I will include it.
And you were referring to section 2?
Section 2.
Motion is to approve sections 1 and 2.
Question.
Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Ginsburg.
Aye.
Ginsburg.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Tanner.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Drinkwitz.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Carried. Section 3.
Aye.
Well, section 3 is the section that establishes the outer limits of or indeterminate sentences for each class of felony. 20 years for a Class A felony, 10 for B, 5 for C, and for an unclassified felony as provided in the statute that defines the crime.
Any discussion?
Yeah, I think those sentences are way too long.
Too long?
Yeah. I'm kind of surprised. It's about twice as long.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in comparison with other revisions that we've looked at, they're the shortest. In fact, they're shorter than any of them that I've found. They're shorter, certainly in terms of the crimes that we've graded into each classification. The overall effect is going to make much shorter sentences in most of the felony areas, particularly in your property crimes area and your non-dangerous offenses.
They're shorter than they are now.
I would agree with all those things. I just can't see where you're going to accomplish anything by sentencing anybody for a period of over 10 years. Good God, that's an awful long time to begin with, and then to add another 10 to it, make it 20. I can't believe that the purpose of the system is supposed to be that
really, Bob, what you're getting at, though, and in a way, it's fortunate in a way, it's unfortunate, it's not really good for us. What you're really getting at is a failure, I think, of our present penal system.
I don't think that the period from 10 years and one day on is going to accomplish anything at all. If you've got a guy in a hoose cow for 10 years and you haven't been able to do something with him, why?
The only thing is
send him out and send him back
for another dangerous, he's a dangerous offender and protects society.
Bob, the only ones in Class A.
I read through the thing, and I realized that Class A felonies are few in number, and they're serious offenses.
Still feel we should reduce it.
Well,
Parole
board functions we have, this not take care of that isolated or occasional case when it may seem to society that it's proper to impose a more severe and longer sentence in that particular case? And then the parole board and the other rehabilitation...
Well, I just look upon it from the standpoint of the corrections division, perhaps, on the person who's incarcerated, sentenced as we see it being going, where the judge in most cases will say, for these class A felonies, I'm going to sentence you to the corrections division for a period of not more than 20 years. I suspect he's going to be a problem.
Well, that may be, but in most cases where 20 years is imposed, it isn't going to be a first offender.
I realize that.
They're going to be composed of individuals who have a pretty damn good knowledge of what that sentence is prior to the time of commission of that offense.
I suppose I get carried away by my own personal experience. Not that
well, you haven't served a lot of time.
Years, but I haven't served a lot of time. But in the last two or three years, I've been trying in between revocations of parole and so forth and so on to quite a couple of people. This state is set up for long periods of time. And I don't think neither one of them is out of the woods by any means as yet. But they've men in their middle 30s and spent most of their time since the age of 16 in some form of custody in this state. One of them is no better off now, 20 years later. No better risk to be out than he was when he was 16. The other guy has a slightly better risk than he was when he was 16.
Well, Bob, maybe a business sacrifice, but it just means you're going to have to be patient and wait longer for your man.
What else you have to say, Bob?
Any further discussion?
The chairman is really rambling.
No, I certainly don't want to
be
rushing.
No, I don't.
Section 3, any further discussion?
Move it up.
Heard the motion. Call roll.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Sandy Burns.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Chandler.
No.
Frost. Hobbs.
Aye.
Grimsdale.
Aye.
Horton.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Chairman.
Aye. Section 4.
One case where you're certainly agreeing with the wrong order.
Do you think that these maximums are too high? 20
years?
You changed.
No, I thought that for some time.
You said, and there may be some error.
I think the basic problem with the system is that it's not sure enough and it's not fast enough and getting the guy through the system and into some form of custody or correction or something like that. And then we shouldn't take so damn long to turn them loose after they are in.
I got a subject that cured that.
Have you? You read the new... mostly on civil law, but you read John Frank's collection of lectures from the opening of the Warren Center down here at Berkeley a little while ago. He spent a relatively little time, part of one lecture on criminal law, most of it was on civil law.
Preventive detention.
Well, he was pretty darn...
And revocation of the right to bail and appeal.
You've been talking to Herb Schwab.
He's been talking to me.
Oh.
George.
But I think that Frank makes awful good points in one part that he did. And Schwab has got the same basic idea that we take too long to get them into the system and then hold on too long after we've got them in jail.
Of course, that's true. But you still have, I think, within your penal systems, have a means to, at least, if nothing else, considering that some of these people are never going to be rehabilitated. Some of them are not rehabilitatable. And that is, you defer the risk to society, that's what you're doing. You at least keep them segregated for as long as you can. And we've articulated that as one of protection of the public is one of the purposes of our criminal code.
That's correct.
And,
I just looked at the thought of, at the effect upon the possibility of rehabilitating some guy when you ship him up there, sit there in the black robe and say, go up there for a period not to exceed 20 years. The only word he hears is the 20 years. You know, the not to exceed part doesn't register on him at all at that time.
I think we have to recognize this too, that I think we've got a good structure here, frankly, generally. I think it gives some good guidelines, but it's the kind of structure that the legislature, as it goes through the years, is going to have to keep in mind when new crimes are created, and that it's going to defeat the whole purpose of what we've done if they classify everything as every new crime as a Class A felon. I mean, this has to be applied properly.
Another commission back here. Same old members.
Section, let's move on to section.
Wider of hair and longer of two.
I move to adopt section 4.
Heard the motion. Discussion? I'm missing it. A, B, C, and unclassified.
Second.
Bob, you have any views on that?
No, I think that's right.
Call for question?
Question.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 5.
Mr. Chairman, now, this is a section that was adopted, at least in principle, by the Grading and Sentencing Subcommittee, in which it sets up a schedule of fines for felons. It follows the Michigan approach. We have 5 and then 6 is fines for misdemeanors and violations. They both follow Michigan. 7 then sets up criteria for imposing fines. These are based on recommendations contained in the bar standards. And then also Section 8, I think we have to kind of look at all these together. Section 8, fines for corporations. These were, Sections 5 through 9 were not in the first draft. They were approved by the subcommittee. And we provide basically a $2,500 fine for an A, B, or C felony. Unclassified felony would be as provided in the statute. And then there's an alternative fine set up under subsection 3 of section 5. That is, if a person has gained money or property through the commission of a felony, the court, in lieu of 1 and 2, can sentence the defendant to pay an amount not exceeding double the amount of his gain. And we define under sub 4 the term gain. Value, that term that appears in the last sentence in subsection 4, and that will refer to our definition of that term in our staff article. The court is required under 5 to make a finding as to the amount of the defendant's gain, and provides the court, if it doesn't feel it has sufficient evidence, the record, to have a hearing on the issue, but section 5 does not apply to the corporation.
I read part of this. I read this. Yeah, I get it. But it's now has in the Class A, B, or C problems, fine instead of going to jail, fine a maximum of $2,500. If a person has embezzled $7,000, a judge can sentence him to pay $14,000.
Right.
If I read this correctly.
Right.
And the $14,000 is paid, this doesn't say, it's quite stated, to whom? $7,000 to the state, the $7,000 to the person who's embezzled from?
No, this isn't restitution. No, this is a fine.
This is to the state, then?
Yes.
All right. where does restitution enter the picture? I was kind of confused as I got through the sections, or does it?
In the condition of probation.
That's right, it doesn't come under these sanctions.
It doesn't.
The court has power now to order restitution under existing law. We're not changing.
In addition, then, so if somebody has embezzled $7,000, and Judge Burns wants to sentence him to pay a fine of $14,000, plus pay me the $7,000 that he embezzled from me before I give him probation, why he's going to have a $21,000, right? Fine, in effect.
Good.
Wow.
But how often do courts avail themselves of that restitution section?
I use it whenever the guy is reasonably capable of paying restitution, and I put him on probation. There's no reason in the world why the victim should go uncompensated if the defendant has the means to repay the harm done.
You'd use this in a case in lieu of both fine and jail sentence.
How often do you find?
Not very often.
Not very often. At all. Very seldom.
Because normally the guy that is in front of you probably is having difficulty meeting his obligations to family and so forth. It doesn't make sense. Normally. Occasionally, you find a case where you're
concerned. Well, I was trying to get. I didn't want to get into saying we've got a $2,500 fine in one place and then create the possibility of what in effect is a $21,000 fine.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman, about can the judge impose a fine as well as a sentence?
Yeah.
And we provided for that earlier.
Where is that?
Under, on page 1 of article, or page 2, excuse me, of article 8. Five, C, both imprisonment and a fine. Under A, imprisonment or a fine, or both imprisonment and a fine.
I suppose the court would only do this on somebody most other than his own.
Have you seen this one?
Defendant X is convicted of a Class B felony. The court is not going to look at the circumstances and say, well, I'm going to require you to pay $14,000 unless the district attorney has asked that this sort of procedure.
Yeah, it would normally, come up to be in the pre-sentence or
a recommendation.
Yeah.
Or at least the question
to
raise.
Yeah.
I don't expect to use
the DA, which in Multnomah County, the DA, by practice, does not make any recommendations.
Yesterday.
But it would. It would, I think it would normally be for the pre-sentence.
Now, Section 7 is important to keep in mind here, that sets a criteria for to follow, which it doesn't have now. And this was a recommendation.
I think the explanation for this in the ABA standards is that whole area is a good explanation.
What's the general? Does the courts already now have the ability to those fines be paid on a solid basis?
They do anyway.
They do.
They do, and nobody's, who's going to squawk?
Yeah, sure. Do you charge interest on the unpaid balance?
I haven't done it, I don't know.
It's honest people.
Wait till we get to the draft tomorrow. I worry about what we're doing with the honest people.
All right, is there any further discussion on Section 5?
I move
fines for felonies. Motion's been made to be approved.
Further discussion? Not call roll.
Bedford.
Aye.
Senator.
Aye.
Carson. Chandler.
Aye.
Haas.
Aye.
Durnstead.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Section 6, fines for misdemeanors and violations.
Just the counterpart of Section 5. Court has the same discretion with respect to the alternative fine that has in Section 6.
Thousands of Class A, 500 B, 250 for C, 250 for violation. Classified ones, whatever the statute says. Any discussion on that?
I move we approve it.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Here's Section 7, Bob, that's relevant to what we talked about, criteria for.
Why do we need this?
Well, because the subcommittee voted to put it in the meeting on the draft.
Exactly, because of the Chandler argument.
Oh.
I think it's a good thing.
Only,
I don't know it anyway.
This doesn't put in all the ABA standards by any means, but these two were picked out of there by the subcommittee, and I was directed to put a section in incorporating those two criteria.
And those are the two most important ones, aren't they?
Yes.
What I've forgotten what I read in the ABA thing with it around a year or so.
Hey, get me. Direct me to where I can read those Berkeley lectures. I would read those.
Well, for $5.95, I can buy them for you bound, or if you want to write me a note, I'll be glad to loan you my copy.
What are they?
Ben Bullitt.
No.
What's the name of it?
It's called American Law, The Case for Radical Reform, and a guy named John P. Frank. He's a lawyer in Phoenix, and I forgot the name of the publisher, but that's the...
I'll drop you a line.
I'll loan you my copy, but you've got to be better than some of my friends will return it to some
degree. Do I prepay the post fees both ways?
Both ways.
To answer Mr. Chandler's question, there's quite a bit of material here. Do you want to go through it all or something?
No, I'm just wondering what some of the other.
Well, probably the two most important we did not adopt. The extent to which payment of a fine will interfere with the ability of the defendant to make any order of restitution or reparation to the victim of the crime, and whether there are particular reasons which make a fine appropriate as a deterrent to the offense involved or appropriate as a corrective measure for the defendant.
Those are both of which judicial discretion anyway.
And to a certain extent,
they wanted to say revenue production is logical and is not a legitimate basis for the stay away from things like $30 or 30 days.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Section 8, and it was because of you that we went up to 50,000.
I know
that. Started
at
5.
I just felt good all over, Larry.
It's called the Chandler motivation.
Boy, Lloyd Fry is glad that he got convicted this year and not next year.
Oh, did he get convicted?
His company did.
He had a number.
He refuses our invitation so far. Welcome to Oregon, Lloyd.
Okay, now this is based on New York laws, Section 8010. This was approved in the subcommittee, except the only difference from the New York provision is that we provide for a $50,000 fine for a felon, a corporation. I think the other two, for the other fines,
great job.
Section 8.
You've heard the motion, Section 8. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Carried. Section 9, costs.
Here again, this is new stuff. This is from Michigan again now.
That's this contumacious.
Nasty.
That's the description of the girls that we saw this
week. I thought that was
no.
there's some important stuff in here, actually. Sub two.
Gee, this means he wants us to spend at least a minute and a half on this section.
Please tell us what it is.
I think it's good.
Good.
Good and important.
Sub two, cost shall be limited to expenses specially incurred by the state and prosecutor and defendant. They cannot include expenses inherent in providing a constitutionally guaranteed jury trial. Expenditures in connection with the maintenance and operation of government agencies that must be made to the public, irrespective of specific violations of law. And three is kind of, I think we need it. It sort of says the obvious.
Well, he restates the criteria. That's right. Well, why do we need it?
No,
well,
because this
restates the cost.
Because this is section 1525 from Michigan, which is what the subcommittee is about.
I have a question. Where's the provision to pay the defense cost?
That just isn't in here. I think maybe it'd be a good idea.
No. Why? What's more terrifying financially if we go a substantial, serious felony
I go with you, Harold. What are you going to do in the case of the jury pardon, where you got a guy who stands up on the stand and says, "Yes, I shot my wife. I came home and found her in bed with another man, so I shot her," and he's been charged by a Gresham District Attorney in Benton County with first degree murder, and
probably deserved.
But he's acquitted, and he's the only punishment he's going to get for shooting his wife is have to pay some attorney in Benton County a substantial sum of money to get him to defend him.
I just concept of cost.
What cost does the defendant incur other than attorney's fees?
Investigation. Expert,
what cost does the state incur?
Well, investigation, expert witnesses, all kinds of same thing.
You could assess the prorated share of the court costs, however much they say in Multnomah County, $400 a day for running the court. You can assess that against the district attorney and make him pay it out of his budget for arbitrarily and capriciously persisting in trying some of these cases that they damn well shouldn't do. And I think Harold makes a damn good point, because it's going on. And it's a waste of public funds on the part of some district attorneys.
Anything else is loaded on the side of the state. If loading costs on the defendant in addition to everything else he doesn't have,
well, of course, if the defendant is not ordered to pay costs, who pays the costs? The state pays them.
The prosecutor.
No. So the state's paying the costs anyway.
Well, I'm persuaded, of course, in some respects, that we ought to have more cost assessed in some cases. Get back to the discussion that John has had with Judge Schwab lately. There's a lot of delay and this, that, and the other thing. How many people they got in England? 90 million people, and they got 90 judges in their whole darn system. I feel like